from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, memory and forgetting.
What we're doing here, Mr. Barish, is actually creating a map of your brain.
Okay, let's
In different start. Regions of the brain, hippocampus for consciously oriented memories and the amygdala, the striatum, the cerebellum, mediate this implicit unconscious memory.
So the time that we spend remembering and the time that we spend living are on different scales, and yet we give enormous importance to the time we spend remembering and to the stories we tell.
Our values relating to memory are changing in a way that's really very remarkable. Being able to move past some memory and never have access to it again might be good for us.
By the time you wake up in the morning, all the memories we've targeted would have withered and disappeared, as in a dream upon waking.
Is there any risk of brain damage?
Well, technically speaking, the procedure is brain damage, but it's on a par with a night of heavy drinking. Nothing you'll miss.
Well, not exactly. But scientists are now looking for ways to alter and even erase some of our memories. Today, we'll explore the science of memory as we talk with Nobel laureates Eric Kandel and Daniel Kahneman. Also, the art of the memoir. Would you like to sharpen your memory? Not just a little, but dramatically? What if I handed you a deck of 52 cards in random order and gave you 5 minutes to memorize them in sequence? Could you do it? You might, with a few tips from Joshua Foer, author of the book Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. He says the trick is to tell yourself an unforgettable story. Here's how he did it.
Dom DeLuise, celebrity fat man and five of clubs, has been implicated in the following unseemly acts in my mind's eye. He has hocked a fat globule of spittle, nine of clubs, on Albert Einstein's thick white mane, three of diamonds, and delivered a devastating karate kick, five of spades, to the groin of Pope Benedict XVI, six of diamonds. Michael Jackson, the king of hearts, has engaged in behavior bizarre even for him. He has defecated two of clubs on a salmon burger, king of clubs, and captured his flatulence, queen of clubs, in a balloon, six of spades. Rhea Perlman, diminutive Cheers bartendress and queen of spades, has been caught cavorting with the 7'7" Sudanese basketball star Manute Bol, seven of clubs, in a highly explicit and in this case anatomically improbable two-digit act of Congress, three of clubs.
You know, those are very vivid images, and I think you need to explain.
Well, those images were conjured up in my mind's eye when I was training to enter a bizarre contest called the United States Memory Championship. And the reason that they are so bizarre is because their bizarreness makes them memorable. And what I was trying to do was transform something unmemorable, a deck of playing cards, into something that I would find unforgettable, which Dom DeLuise is.
Well, how did you get started on this? I mean, I get the explanation, but wanting to get there, I guess, is what we're really going to talk about, and then why it works.
Well, it's a bizarre story. There's a contest held every spring in New York City called the United States Memory Championship that I had gone to cover in 2005 as a science journalist. And I had shown up expecting to find a bunch of individuals with, you know, photographic memories, I suppose, savants, I don't know, because they were able to memorize entire poems, hundreds of random numbers. And what I found was something different. The people who were competing in this contest all told me that they had just average memories and that they had trained themselves to perform these incredible mental gymnastics. And I was intrigued and ended up spending the better part of the next year training my memory and also investigating it, trying to understand, you know, how it works.
How long did it take you to begin to believe that they were telling you the truth? Because they were doing what most of us would recognize as extraordinary feats.
Right. And my mind was blown. I ended up meeting a fellow named Ed Cook, who had one of the best trained memories in England. And he told me that, you know, he'd be happy to teach me some of these ancient techniques. It turns out the techniques that these guys were using date back to ancient Greece. These were the same techniques that Cicero used to memorize his speeches, that medieval scholars used to memorize entire books. What he showed me was a technique that was supposedly invented 2,500 years ago by the Greek poet Simonides. It's known as the Memory Palace, and it involves essentially creating an imagined building in your mind's eye and filling that building with imagery. The weirder and more bizarre, the better. And when you walk back through that building, you can see those images that you left behind earlier.
So if you want to remember your shopping list, you could put a banana on the sofa and cottage cheese in the refrigerator, I suppose. And I'm not sure what I'd put in the bathroom, but it would be memorable if I put it there.
Right. Maybe it's your orange juice or whatever the third item is that you need to pick up. But once upon a time, these techniques were not only widely known, but widely practiced. You know, people actually had to depend on their memories, which is an idea that's kind of foreign to us today. Today we have iPhones and Blackberries and, you know, Google. We've essentially outsourced the role of remembering to technology.
I can see putting bananas on the sofa, even though it's illogical. I can see even orange juice in the bathtub. Where I start to wonder about this is the random digits. I mean, in this memory championship, you have to memorize 1,000 random digits in order. Do you put them all over the memory palace?
To compete at a high level in this quote-unquote sport, you need to have lots and lots of memory palaces. The people who take this very seriously are collectors of architecture, actually. They're walking around and they go into a building and they say, would this make a good memory palace? And if it will, they save it to store their memories later. Once upon a time, in the 15th century, one of my favorite stories, there was a guy called Peter of Ravenna who had thousands of memory palaces, and he filled them with quotes and sources and facts that he wanted to use. He was a lawyer.
Of course, you also tell the story of one of the contestants in the National Memory Championships, I believe, who memorized, oh, I don't know how many thousand digits of pi, only to be beaten, and afterward, painstakingly went through his memory palace to get those digits out of there.
Oh, it's such a depressing story. Yeah, he had memorized 50,000 digits of pi. He was going to set a world record. Somebody comes out of the woodwork and memorizes 80,000. And he had to then cleanse his memory palaces. He actually walked through them and imagined scrubbing the walls to erase these images so that they wouldn't interfere with other things that he would then use those memory palaces for.
You're right. It's depressing. Now, you're a science journalist. You were intrigued by all of this. You must have also wondered why it works.
Right. It's a good question. One answer you might give is to say that, look, the environment in which the human brain evolved is pretty different from the environment in which we live in today. One thing our ancestors who made their livings as hunter-gatherers didn't need to remember was phone numbers and word-for-word instructions from their bosses in the AP US history curriculum or whatever. What they did need to remember was where they found the food, where the resources were, the route back home. It's not surprising that we would have well-developed visual and spatial memories. It's what the brain was built for.
There's been a lot of research that you've looked into as well. There are odd people. In fact, early in the book, there's a man who's, I guess, well-known within the field, but goes by the initial S.
Yeah. S supposedly remembered almost everything. What's fascinating about him is that he was essentially dysfunctional. I mean, he remembered too much and really couldn't hold down a job. He was a journalist by training, but never was very successful at it. Ended up making his living as a stage performer, essentially memorizing stuff on stage. It suggests something about memory that's actually quite profound, which is that it's not remembering so much as forgetting. That's actually the essence of thinking and of being human at some level. S couldn't make those distinctions. The trivial was just as important to him as the profound. And as a result, he couldn't sort. He couldn't make his way through the world.
The other end of this is another study that you looked into, a man who goes by the initials EP.
Yeah, I spent some time out in San Diego with EP. EP had what is probably the worst memory in the world. He subsequently passed away, unfortunately. In 1992, a freakish virus attacked his brain, essentially cored it like an apple, and knocked out the hippocampal regions, which are responsible for turning our perceptions into long-term memories. And without those hippocampal regions, he not only had lost everything that had happened to him since about 1950, he was also incapable of forming new memories. And what that meant was that he lived almost completely and entirely in the present. I mean, he didn't even remember that he had a memory problem, which is quite astounding. And the thing that really astounded me about EP was that he was happy living in this. He was like this perfect pathological Buddha, living completely and entirely in the present between this past that he couldn't remember and this future that he couldn't contemplate.
Well, this is the fascinating thing, isn't it? Because all of us are, especially those of us who are a little older, get concerned about loss of memory, about not being able to pull the right word up at the right time, about not being able to remember the car keys, about glancing at a shopping list and saying, oh, there are only three things on it. I'll just go to the store and I'll pick all three up. And you get there and you may remember one. Does what you've learned help with that?
If you want to remember stuff, you've got to be the kind of person who remembers to remember. You've got to pay attention. I mean, when you put down those car keys and you don't remember where you put them, it's because you put them down absentmindedly. You weren't paying attention, which is fine. It's not important. But you can be the kind of person who moves through life treating everything like that. And, you know, everything is like you're just throwing down your car keys. And that's a recipe for a forgettable life. If we're going to remember stuff, we've got to be mindful. We've got to be present. We've got to be there. We've got to realize that, hey, I want to remember this.
Joshua Foer's book is called Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. By the way, Joshua went on to win the U.S. Memory Championship. Suppose you could remember every day of your life. Would that be a blessing or a curse? For Jill Price, it's definitely been a burden. She is one of only a half dozen people who've been diagnosed with hyperthymesia, which is a fancy word for nearly total recall. Price is now in her mid-40s, and she can remember every day of her life since the age of 14.
Let's see, 20 years ago today, I was in New York with my parents. My dad was an agent at William Morris, so we were here for the upfronts, and then we went to Florida for the weekend. And that weekend was the one-year anniversary that we had found out my mother had a brain tumor. So I was actually not fun to be around that time. I describe it like as if somebody's following me around with a video camera on my shoulder, and then each day is a tape on a shelf, and as soon as the day is mentioned, it's as if someone took the video and put it in a VCR, and I see the day. You know, everyone has points in their life where they're not, you know, proud of or happy, you know, bad decisions or bad experiences. And the thing is that, you know, people who have normal memories, that fades eventually, or it somehow fades, you know. I don't know how much because I don't have a normal memory, but I can't turn them off. You can't turn your brain off. I can't turn my brain off. I don't know about anyone else. But it's the good memories that get me through and comfort me and I guess have kept me sane. I remember when I was 17, I saw a woman in the bank who, she looked like Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies, and she was in her bathrobe, and she was screaming at the top of her lungs because she didn't know where she was. And the man that was standing next to me told the man standing next to him that she had Alzheimer's, and I had never heard of that before. And I've never forgotten her. And so when this all came about, she's somebody who I kept thinking of, and the kind of pain I saw in her face and fright. That, you know, I hope that with them studying me and that if other people come forward, they can study a whole group of us and hopefully find something that we have in our brains, or I have in my brain, that could help other people.
Jill Price is the co-author of the memoir, The Woman Who Can't Forget. Now, imagine a life where you couldn't remember anything that happened more than a few minutes ago. Terrifying thought, right? Well, that happened to a man known in the medical literature as HM. Surgeons removed part of his brain in an attempt to cure his epilepsy, and he ended up one of the most famous cases in the history of memory research. So, what does his brain tell us about how memory works? Shortly before HM died, I asked Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist Eric Kandel, one of the world's leading experts on the science of memory.
He was left with the most dramatic memory deficit you could possibly imagine. He cannot take new short-term information and put it into new long-term information. HN can remember things that happened to him prior to the operation. He can remember his childhood traumata. He can remember going to elementary school and high school. Everything that happened before the operation is fine. He has a good short-term memories. So if you introduce him to Jim Fleming, he will be able to repeat Jim Fleming's name. Introduce him to Eric Kandel, he'll repeat Eric Kandel. Comes back to Jim Fleming, he's forgotten it completely. So his difficulty is taking new information, like Jim Fleming, and putting this into long-term memory. So when he sits down to eat a meal, as soon as he's finished it, he thinks he hasn't had a meal. Starts all over again. He starts reading a newspaper. By the time he's finished the first column, he's forgotten it. He starts all over again. Just a remarkable deficit.
But at the same time, if I understood this correctly, there were some skills that he was able to pick up without remembering them. Physical skills he could learn. He didn't remember that he'd learned them, but he still had them.
There were certain skills he could learn and he could remember. These were perceptual and motor skills. But he, in fact, on an unconscious level, acquired all these skills. And many of the things we do, much of mental life, as Freud first pointed out, is unconscious.
In fact, these things are happening in different parts of the brain, and the transfer is taking place in different parts of the brain.
Absolutely. There are two major memory systems in the brain, a conscious memory system and an unconscious memory system. And they have different names. The most convenient is explicit for conscious and implicit for unconscious. They involve different brain regions. So the explicit memory, which is a memory for people, places and objects, and if I think about a person like my wife Denise, I have to make a conscious effort to recall her face. On the other hand, when it comes to grammar, this is implicit, this is completely unconscious. And different regions of the brain, hippocampus for consciously oriented memories, and the amygdala, the striatum, the cerebellum. In the simplest cases, the reflex pathways themselves mediate this implicit unconscious memory. Much of my work, certainly everyone's work in simple invertebrate animals, is on implicit memory storage.
What does this mean when it comes to an exploration of other kinds of memory? I know you have done a fair amount of research on the question of aging and memory, which is very much in the popular mind right now. Are these related?
Yes. So in addition to thinking of explicit, implicit memory storage, it's useful to think of memory as having two other components. One is the storage mechanism. How is memory stored at any given site in the brain? And the other is the systems problem. What are the different sites that are involved in memory storage? Hippocampus versus amygdala, for example, or hippocampus versus striatum. It turns out that the storage mechanism, the mechanisms that are used at each one of these sites, has conserved elements. The same molecules are used for implicit and explicit memory storage, even though the neural circuitry is different. So we began to explore age-related memory loss by looking at complex memories, memory for people, places, and objects, and we did this in a mouse. The mouse ages, and when mice age, a significant percentage of them show a weakening of memory with age. We could look at the storage mechanism and we could see what went wrong. And it was a little bit like a nutritional deficiency, like diabetes. We could give the equivalent of insulin and make the memory better. So if you're a mouse, we can treat your age-related memory deficits perfectly well. In people, we're not sure as yet. But one of the interesting things about evolution and mental processes is the notion of combinatorial. You can take a few building blocks, if you will, to make a much richer set of processes.
Is it a value to have that richer storage of memory when it comes to the loss of memory due to aging, or is it in fact a problem?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons elaborate memories tend to disappear is because they are elaborate. So if you break down at any given point, it degenerates the memory a little bit. So it is wonderful when memory is functioning well because it gives us the nuanced, sophisticated ability to recall smells and sounds and contexts and feeling states. On the other hand, when you have something elaborate, it's more susceptible to breaking down.
This is why when I can't remember a word that I know perfectly well, it may be the intervening processes that are getting in the way, even though that word is stored somewhere.
Absolutely. Other distracting thoughts may interfere with that. You're absolutely right.
Do you feel as though the biology of memory is going to be the determining factor? Is it purely a biological function?
100%. This doesn't make it any less romantic, any less wonderful. Look, you and I know that my heart and your heart are a muscular pump that drives blood through the circulation. But that doesn't make it any less magnificent, interesting, and wonderful to behold.
Eric Kandel is a Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist at Columbia University.
Remember the Alamo. Remember the Sabbath day, and keep it holy. But why remember a destructive love affair? Here at Lacuna, we have perfected a safe, effective technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories. Our patented non-surgical procedure will rid you of painful memories and allow you a new and lasting peace of mind you never imagined possible. Don't forget, with Lacuna, you can forget.
A scene from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a movie that's all about the science of memory. So would you erase painful memories if you could? Coming up, why that idea is no longer just science fiction. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Memory and Forgetting, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Do you think your memory's like a movie camera or a tape recorder, a device that can record and store every experience you've ever had so that years later you can pull up your 10th birthday party, remember the candles and the cake, who was there, what you did? Historian Alison Winter believes most of us use technology metaphors to think about memory. And as technology changes, so do our ideas about how memory works. Anne Strainchamps talks with Alison about her new book, Memory, Fragments of a Modern History.
Alison, is the way we think now about memory very different from how people thought about it maybe 100 years ago?
It is. I think that our values relating to memory are changing now in a way that's really very remarkable. There's a new, maybe you would say, a sort of a model for how to value memory and how not to value it that's coming into play at the moment. Being able to move past some memory and never have access to it again might be good for us.
What is this new model?
So since the 70s at least, it's been commonly understood that when you have a new experience or you learn something, that information has to become consolidated in the brain, stored. At that time, it was assumed that the memories were just there. They were a permanent part of your brain. But in the late 90s and in the last decade, new research has indicated that when a memory is called to consciousness and the parts of the brain where the memory is stored are activated, that information has to be consolidated again. And it's possible to alter that memory, or at least certain features of the memory.
Sort of as though if the memory is a tape recorder, there's no such thing as just playback. You're always hitting play and record at the same time, you know, so that whenever you play, you're also potentially recording something new.
Yes, and that's one of the things that I think is really fascinating about the technology metaphors. The metaphor that I've heard people use more often is it's like calling a file up on your computer. If you call up a word process document on your computer, as you're reading it, you might see some typos or some infelicities that you want to change, and then you save it.
So you're constantly updating.
Yes, constantly updating. of course, the same is true of digital images. This work on the brain has happened during the same period when people switched from the film camera to the digital camera and became adept at altering digital photographs. So I have thousands of photographs of my kids, and I've cropped them and tweaked the color or the lighting. So those files that I've kept permanently are the edited ones, not the originals.
This leads into thinking about how to deal with unwanted memories or memories that are difficult or painful. I mean, until fairly recently, the idea was that people with traumatic memories, veterans say, need to talk about those memories, that the act of catharsis would, you know, purge the trauma. But I think there's a new picture emerging now, correct?
Absolutely. The new memory therapists say if you can find some way of truly forgetting some aspect of your traumatic memory, great, it's not going to bother you anymore. What they're able to do now is to take certain drugs. The ones I know about are beta blockers. I don't know if there are other ones that people have come up with, which inhibit the release of stress hormones. And they give these to people, and then they have them remember the traumatic event. But the purpose of that act of remembering is not to better understand the event. It's to alter the emotional memory associated with the event. So when that memory is reconsolidated, the idea is that the stress hormones that are triggered by the memory will be altered so that the next time the memory is relived, those stress hormones won't be released, at least not in the original level.
Well, I've seen this talked about in the press as drugs that will erase, quote unquote, erase memories. That doesn't exactly sound like what you're describing.
No, that's an exaggeration as far as I've understood it. But it's also an example of that technological metaphor. What's tempting is to think, oh, well, we can erase the file.
Sure, it's or like we, hitting the delete button.
Yeah, or we can Photoshop out part of the memory. But maybe it is a little bit like Photoshop in the sense that you can soften the emotional response.
But isn't there something creepy about this? Because isn't, you know, what if you have an entire army of people who've committed wartime atrocities and you bring them home and give them these drugs and they remember the atrocities, but they don't care?
Some people will say it's creepy and other people will say, how can you be so precious about this? People who are suffering and want relief from their psychic suffering now have a tool. An interesting moment of comparison is the history of anesthesia, because I think we're at a similar moment to the invention of anesthesia. Before about the 1840s, almost nobody had recourse to anything besides a bit of alcohol, maybe, when they had a surgical operation. But in the 1840s, inhalation anesthetics came into wide use. Before they existed, the idea of anesthesia was deeply troubling.
Why? What would be troubling about anesthesia?
The problem was, before the inhalation anesthetics, there were people who claimed to be able to suspend sensation and consciousness. They were mesmerists who were like the precursors to hypnotists. And they claimed that they could induce a trance that would put you in a sensory state where you couldn't feel an operation taking place. And there were very violent controversies over mesmerism, because the very idea that you could put somebody into a state of suspended sensibility was a moral outrage. One editor of a leading medical journal said, you mustn't, not that you can't, but you mustn't believe these claims. Because if they were true, the teeth could be pulled from your head and you wouldn't even be aware. Now, nowadays,
we would like our teeth pulled without being aware of it.
Exactly. We're living in a post-anesthesia period. But to this guy, he didn't even have to explain what he meant. Consciousness and sensibility in the sense of fully experiencing every sensory event was a really integral part of oneself. And if you could suspend that, especially if another person could do something to you that would suspend it, that there was something deeply troubling that undermined our authenticity of ourselves.
So are you suggesting a parallel to the new drugs that might erase bad memories? In a way, you know, we're pulling a bad tooth.
We are at the beginning of a psychic anesthesia age. I mean, the difference, of course, is that anesthesia is temporary and these memory therapies aren't. But a thing I think is compelling about the comparison is that these new treatments raise huge problems of the self that have to do with the relationship of pain, psychic pain, and personal authenticity. And those guys who were worrying about anesthesia in the 1830s, if they could have got into a time machine and just zapped themselves into the 1850s, they would have been stunned at the fact that, you know, Queen Victoria was delivering her children using chloroform and that everybody was happy about it.
Alison Winter is a historian at the University of Chicago and the author of Memory, Fragments of a Modern History. She spoke with Anne Strangehamps. Do you ever ache for a piece of your past? Maybe a younger version of yourself that feels long gone? Novelist and essayist Andre Aciman knows all about longing, even if the past he remembers never really existed, except in his imagination.
I was born in Alexandria, Egypt, but I am not Egyptian. I was born into a Turkish family, but I am not Turkish. I was sent to British schools in Egypt, but I am not British. My family became Italian citizens, and I learned to speak Italian, but my mother tongue is French. For years as a child, I was under the misguided notion that I was a French boy who, like everyone else I knew in Egypt, would soon be moving back to France. Back to France was already a paradox, since virtually no one in my immediate family was French or had ever set foot in France. But France and Paris was my sole home, my imaginary home, and will remain so all my life, even if, after 3 days in France, I cannot wait to get out. Not a single ounce of me is French.
Andre Aciman now lives in New York City, but he still considers himself an exile without a country that's really his own. In his new collection of essays called Alibis, Aciman reflects on his memories of various places he's loved. He recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
One theme that comes up over and over in your essays is memory, but it's a very complicated notion of memory, not just remembering what happened, but it might be the memory of a longing or a disappointment, or as you put it, of imagined happiness. Why is memory so central to your writing?
I think there are many answers one could give to that. One of them is because when you've lost something that you believe is important, you always revisit that loss. You tend to look back more than you look forward, because you're always trying to recreate the narrative that brought you here. You're trying to understand, you know, what is this trajectory? What is the itinerary that brought you to where you are today? Not to have that is to feel completely lost.
Is there always an element of longing then in
yes.
these memories?
Yes. Again, it's a complicated question. You long for something that was in the past, that was very important, and then you spend your whole life trying to recover it. Most people have that when it comes to their childhood. Even if it was a bad childhood, they long to recover those footsteps. In my case, I long to recover something that I never loved. So that puts me in a totally paradoxical position. In my case, the big mysterious place is Alexandria.
Alexandria, Egypt.
Right. That's where I come from. That's where I was born. And that's where I was kicked out of as a Jew who had to leave Egypt. But I never liked Alexandria. Whom am I kidding? I've never kidded myself. I wanted to get out of Alexandria. But nevertheless, this is the place that I go back to when I try to understand what happened to me, who I am, where am I going? How can you know where you're going if you don't know where you've come from?
So this is not nostalgia, then. This is something different.
Oh, yes, it is. And many people confuse it with nostalgia because that's the easy name for it. It is not, because you cannot be nostalgic for something that you couldn't wait to get out of. There's also another component. It's the idea that most of our memories are made up of things we wished we had and never got. And so those become memories too, by the way.
So in other words, a memory is not always an accurate recreation of what actually happened. It might be quite fictional.
Totally. In other words, if you are in a place, let's say you were in jail and you don't like the jail, and every day in jail you kept thinking of places outside the jail that you've never even visited, but you imagined them. Well, guess what? You will have memories of those places that you never visited, and wishes. So wishes have a long history, and most people cannot tell a wish from an actual event in the past because they got conflated.
Well, this raises all kinds of interesting questions for a memoir writer, because ostensibly you are telling the truth. You are rendering on the page what actually happened. But of course, we know that anyone who's looking back decades to try to recall those details embroiders, perhaps, lies. I don't know.
You could do that. The way I call it, to put a nicer spin on it, is to say that I switch the furniture around. The furniture is all there. But you need to create a narrative. And sometimes very faithful narratives are extremely boring. You need to skip details, or you need to make adjustments so that detail A and detail G follow each other right away as if it were A and B. So you skip steps, but the furniture is all there. So my life in Egypt happened exactly as I tell it. And my family, including those people that lived 50 years before I was born and whose dialogues I couldn't have heard because I wasn't even in my mom's tummy. Okay, nevertheless, I think that I captured their voices and their feelings as accurately as gossip reported it to me. And gossip is, for me, a font of information superior to history.
Do you have any qualms about recreating conversations and actually putting those conversations within quotes? I mean, things that happened decades ago?
Not a single one. And I will tell you ultimately why. Because the people who were there and who said those things said, you captured X and Y's voice perfectly. You captured their personality. This is exactly what I said. No, you couldn't have said that because I invented it. But I got you well enough so that you yourself are persuaded I was writing about you. And that, for a writer, is the ultimate sort of accolade.
Well, it raises fascinating questions about what truth is. You're suggesting that there can be greater truth in a certain degree of fiction.
Well, that goes back to Aristotle, who said, you know, history tells it as it is, you know, literature as it could, might, should have been. And I find that the could, might, should, far more accurate when it comes to people.
Now, if there's one writer who seems to hover over your own writing, it would be Proust, I would think. Sort of this whole question of memory and, you know, how you create a narrative arc out of memory. How formative an influence was he?
Well, Proust is someone I knew when I was a kid. I was 14 years old. My father spoke to me about Proust. It was my father who introduced me to Proust. And he said, you will like Proust. And of course, right away, as soon as he said that, the first impulse was, I'm going to hate Proust. Okay, I'm not sure I like you. So how can I like Proust? But he told me a couple of things about Proust, about memory, smell, and long sentences. And guess what? All three I knew I was fascinated by before reading Proust. So I deferred reading Proust as far as I could, or at least reading the whole book. But once I got into it, it is the most eye-opening experience that I've had intellectually in my whole life, because you are finding on paper somebody who is you. And I think that's the ultimate trick of literature, is to tell you a story that you never had, but is your story.
Andre Osserman is a novelist and memoir writer. He talked with Steve Paulson about his essay collection, Alibis. In a minute, how a story's ending shapes our memory of it. We'll talk with Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Memory and Forgetting is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness. brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Daniel Kahneman is famous for his research on the strange and counterintuitive ways we make decisions. He's the only psychologist ever to win a Nobel Prize in economics. More recently, he won critical raves for his best-selling book, Thinking, Fast, and Slow. Kahneman's also fascinated by the way memory shapes our sense of self. He told Steve Paulson that our memories can be quite different from what we actually experience.
As you go through life, you live the present, and moments of the present are very short. And then they turn out into episodes. So there is one way of thinking about life or thinking about well-being or happiness is the quality of your experience as you go through life. Occasionally, you stop to evaluate yourself or you evaluate an episode or a meeting after it ended. You say, was this a good episode or a bad episode? This is your remembering self. So the experiencing self is the one that answers the question, does it hurt now? The remembering self is answer the question, how was your trip to Albania? Oddly enough, the remembering self doesn't always know what the experiencing self went through. You know, the remembering self tells itself a story about what happened, and that story doesn't always reflect the true experiences that went on in the past.
Well, you have some fascinating experiments that you did. And I have to say, you're a genius in constructing some of these experiments. And one of them was something called the cold hand situation. Can you explain what you did there?
Yes. We asked people to immerse their hand up to the wrist in cold water, in water at 14 degrees Celsius. On one occasion, they had 1 minute at 14 degrees Celsius.
Which we should say is extremely cold.
It's extremely cold. It's tolerable, but it hurts. Then 7 minutes later, we bring them in and we give them another experience. And the other experience could be 1 minute at 14 degrees, just the same as before. But instead of telling people, as we had on the other occasion, take your hand out, here is a warm towel, dry yourself, we did something else. We opened a valve, and during the next 30 seconds, the water became very slightly warmer. In fact, it got to 15 degrees Celsius. So they had an experience that was strictly worse than the other experience. One is 60 seconds of pain and then 30 seconds of diminishing pain, but still painful, not as good as warming your hand with a towel. Then you wait another 7 minutes and you come to those people and you tell them, well, you can choose to repeat either the experience you had with your left hand or the experience you had with your right hand. What do you choose? And the large majority of them choose to expose themselves to the longer experience. That is, they choose to expose themselves to more pain. Why? It's because it ended well. When we tell ourselves stories, how they end is extremely important. So you can take a bad story and make it better by adding suffering, so long as the suffering that you're adding is diminishing, so that it ends as an improvement.
So you like to play with the way people respond to suffering or the way they think about suffering?
Well, I mean, you know, this is the way that people think about lives. I mean, just think about the role of endings in life. So you have that mother and her daughter, and they hadn't been speaking to each other for years, and the mother is dying, and now they get reconciled, and they have an hour together in which they're at peace. This is enormously important to us. The fact that the mother had the experience before she died of meeting her daughter again and loving her daughter again. Now, if you stop to think about it, the emphasis we put on that is ridiculous. It's 1 hour, and they were estranged for years and years. But what we think about, what our remembering self thinks about, it thinks in stories. And the story of the mother is very different when it ends that way. We are storytellers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've often wondered whether we can ever really call up the experience itself, or whether every original experience is tainted by memory. We're always sort of reconstructing it in probably a somewhat fictional way.
Well, that certainly is the case. But in addition, there is a major difference between the experiencing self and the remembering self in how you would weigh episodes in your life. I'll give you an example. Suppose you have a vacation that is 2 weeks long, or the same vacation that is 1 week long, and suppose the second week is just as good as the first. In some real sense, in terms of your experiencing self, the longer vacation is twice as good as the first one, because the second week is as good as the first one, and you had 2 weeks. In terms of the remembering self, there will barely be a difference between a 1 week vacation and a 2 weeks vacation if you stayed in the same place, because you are not adding many new memories. So that the evaluation of life and of episodes in life is very different if you take the perspective of maximizing the quality of experience. Very important when we think of people with Alzheimer's, of elderly people with deficient memories. They still have an experiencing self. They may not remember the experience that they're having, but they are still having experiences, and you can make those better or worse.
Getting back to the vacation example, I've sometimes wondered whether the most important thing about the vacation is the actual experience of it, hopefully it being enjoyable, or whether it's how we think about it later on. Because, you know, the actual experience might only go a week or 2 weeks, but there's a lifetime of what we make of that experience.
Yeah, but there is actually an interesting question, which is how much during the rest of your life do you consume your memories? And I gave a TED talk about this last year, and I told the story of the best vacation of my life, which was in Antarctica, and it was 3 weeks. I know it's the best memory of my life, and I think about it occasionally as the best experience of my life. Now, if I added up how long I have thought about it, you know, in the last 4 years, I estimated it, I mean, wildly as 25 minutes. I mean, in short, very, very little. So the time that we spend remembering and the time that we spend living are on different scales, and yet we give enormous importance to the time we spend remembering and to our memories and to the stories we tell.
Daniel Kahneman is a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book Thinking, Fast and Slow. If you want to hear more from Kahneman, you'll find the entire uncut interview on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind.
It's a phenomenon known as déjà vu. You arrive at a place you've never been, but it feels familiar.
Do you ever have déjà vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen. There is something so familiar about this.
Hmm?
Do you ever have déjà vu?
Didn't you just ask me that?
Déjà vu. If you think it's just a feeling, go back and look again.
Chris Moulin is a cognitive neuropsychologist at England's Leeds University. Memory is one of his main research interests, especially that trick of memory we call déjà vu. Moulin told Anne Strainchamps how he became interested in the phenomenon.
I first got interested in déjà vu as a result of a patient who came to see me whilst I was working in a memory clinic. His wife said he was having constant déjà vu. He felt everything was repeating. The problem was, when his GP said he ought to come and see the memory specialist, he said he'd already been before, and that was really the start of his problems.
Wow, so he had never seen you before, but he thought he had?
Right, exactly.
So how did that play out in his everyday life?
Well, the main thing that you'd notice is that him and other cases like him is that they sort of appear a bit kind of depressed. So they'll stop watching television because they feel that everything's been on before, or they won't read the newspaper because they feel they already know the news events. If you think about your daily life and what's interesting to you, it's the novel things that help you get through each day. If you're just doing the same thing over and over again, you'd soon kind of get a bit you know, dejected and find less interest in the world.
Did you ever see the movie Groundhog Day?
Yeah, so in fact, I didn't see Groundhog Day until after I'd started working with this patient.
That's the movie in which Bill Murray keeps repeating, he keeps reliving Groundhog Day over and over and over again, and he gradually becomes unhinged. I mean, deeply depressed, and
yep. You know,
because it's as though he's caught in this horrible time warp that he can't ever break out of.
Rita, I'm reliving the same day over and over. Groundhog Day, today.
Okay, I'm waiting for the punchline.
No, really, this is the third time. It's like yesterday never happened.
I am racking my brain, but I can't even begin to imagine why you'd make up something like this.
I'm not making it up. I am asking you for help.
Okay, what do you want me to do?
I don't know. You're a producer. Come up with something.
That's really how it feels for your patients? That's terrible.
Yeah, I would imagine it's probably not as extreme as that. I know Bill Murray tries to kill himself and he can't because he just, you know, continues to exist. Of course, there's nothing kind of metaphysical or magical with these people's lives, but there is certainly that extent that they just feel that they've been there, done that, and therefore they're not so interested in engaging in what happens.
So what do you think is going on with your patients? What's causing this kind of very persistent form of déjà vu?
I think cases like this have been around for quite a long time, but only in instances where there's definite brain damage. So the first case seems to be reported in 1876, and this was somebody who went to Pasteur's funeral. He was a French case. He went to Louis Pasteur's funeral, and he claimed he'd already been there before, and it was a state funeral. But he, like my patients, had damage to a particular area of the brain, which was the temporal lobes. And this is a part of the brain very, very important for everyday memory, and this is the area of the brain responsible for that.
Do you think this is a new disease that's just now appearing, or do you think it's something that doctors have just never really noticed before or that patients have kept quiet about?
There's a change in people's willingness to talk about their mental states. So I think it used to be very taboo to talk about these sorts of errors, and people didn't want to share these experiences because they were worried that people would think they were going mad. But now I think that the scientists, psychologists, and medics are understanding these conditions better, but also people are more willing to talk about them.
Chris Mullen is a cognitive psychologist at Leeds University in England. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Memory and Forgetting, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. For transcripts, longer, uncut interviews, and our comic book on the science of consciousness, you'll find them all on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind. Our series was produced by Steve Paulson with the help of Anne Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the theme music. Special thanks to two of our sponsors for Meet Your Mind. Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
PRI, Public Radio International.